Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Now, the Consumer Law Hour with Eddie and Chuck Farah on News 104.5 WOKV.
Good afternoon, Jacksonville. You're listening to the Consumer Law Hour on News 104.5 WOKV. Our lines are open at 855-765-1045. You can talk to our legal experts, Chuck and Eddie Farah from Farah & Farah, the Consumer Law Hour sponsors, here to take your calls. Fellas, welcome back.
Thanks, Scott. It was nice having off last weekend.
Thanks, Scott.
Yeah, man.
Glad you're back in the seat.
Yeah, I know.
Appreciate being here with you.
Thanks for helping us out.
Did you guys do anything fun, exciting, or unmentionable over the Labor Day weekend?
Hung around the house and, you know, like everybody else.
A little storm prep?
Yeah.
Hurricane party?
Hurricane party. And
watch some football.
Watch football and cooked and watched TV.
Well, Jacksonville managed to dodge a bullet as the weather situation went. And I'm glad everybody got through all of that just fine. We're all back here to celebrate the opportunity of hanging out with our callers. 855-765-1045. Again, the number.
I always wonder about the news, you know, because we were looking at the NOAA, the other website, and they kept saying, you know, tendency to go east, but that was really never, you know, I mean, they I wonder if they knew it and they couldn't say it, or
we've got so many different opinions going on there. And of course, the formal line that we'll work with out of the news comes by way of our Action News Jax meteorologist, Mike Burrish, and he in turn is working in conjunction with NOAA, with the National Weather Center,
right,
and watching the track of the storm. You've got all these other influential patterns going on with atmospheric pressure conditions, highs and lows and so forth and so on. But at the end of the day, a hurricane going to do what a hurricane going to do.
Yeah,
and ain't nothing we can do about it except prepare.
I know, but when you had that front moving in from the west, you know that was going to push it out some. So
Yeah. And the question was, does it make landfall here? Does it make landfall along the coast? Does it make it the turn north? Does it do something really erratic and spin all the way around? Because we had that storm a year or two back that actually did a loop-de-loop out in the ocean and then came back and surprised everybody.
Yeah, they're all different. You're right.
Always a good time. Always a chaotic experience.
Oh, I know.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, let's get down to what's going on now. And I want to talk about wage garnishments and bank garnishments. We've talked about this before, about head of households in Florida. Other states have similar provisions that protect head of households from wage and bank garnishments. In Florida, I kind of want to give you what steps you have to take to stop a garnishment. That's like if a credit card company obtains a judgment and wants to come garnish your wages, or a bank, or somebody wants to garnish your bank account or wages or whatever it is. You can take some steps to protect yourself from it. First of all, you have 20 days from the time you receive notice of the garnishment to file your claim of head of household exemption with the court, and you have to mail a copy of that to the attorney for the creditor. So the creditor has to give you notice that they're getting ready to garnish your wages. So when the creditor does that, from the day you receive it, you've got 20 days to respond to it. And you got to file the original with the court and send a copy to the creditor that claims you owe them money. If you don't do it within 20 days, they're gonna probably get their right of garnishment. So you've got to act pretty quickly to make sure that gets done. The document that you need to file to prevent the garnishment should state that you provide more than one half support for a dependent to qualify as a head of household exemption. So you want to show by, you know, that you have maybe minor children in the home, or maybe a disabled sibling or somebody, a parent, a relative, somebody in your household, or maybe not in your household, living somewhere else, that you're providing more than one half of support for. So once you file that, then that should protect you from any garnishment. However, within 14 days from the date you file your head of household exemption with a court, the creditor has to file a sworn affidavit and reply to your exemption. Once all that's been done, the court will have a hearing, and you need to go to that hearing because the judge will then determine whether you are truly head of household. If he does, of course, the garnishment will be dismissed. If you're not, the garnishment will proceed at that point. But that's how it works in Florida. Other states have similar provisions, but in Florida, you got that two-step process of filing your document within 20 days, your head of household, and then going to the hearing to prove that you are head of household. So that's the exemption law in Florida when it comes to wage garnishments.
Now, what happens if, say, a garnishment is filed and your circumstances should change or you should find yourself in a position to need to address that again? Is there a way that you can remove or revoke a garnishment? Is there a petition process for that?
Yeah, I'm sure. You mean if I become a head of household after they obtain the writ of garnishment?
Yeah, exactly. What if your circumstance changes after the garnishment is in place?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think you had to file a motion with the court at that point and ask them to revisit the garnishment order and show that you are now head of household. That's a good question, Scott. Good question. And I think, the court will revisit that again. But, creditors get very aggressive these days because, as you know, they buy this debt. This debt that's out there, I mean, there are people that make
our money's collecting.
They're like PI lawyers. They work on a percentage. They're like us. They don't get paid unless they collect. And so they go out and buy all this debt from credit cards and from credit card companies and banks. And they are very aggressive because the people that are trying, the attorneys that are collecting the money are on a percentage, a lot of them. And so they're going to do whatever they can to get the money. And so you got to be aware of their tactics and go ahead and use the law to your benefit.
Is there a statute of limitations during which time they've got a window to file against that claim?
Not really. As long as the judgment is valid. See, by this time, if there's a garnishment order or they're trying to get obtain a garnishment, a writ of garnishment, then they have some sort of court order. There's probably there's a final judgment somewhere. And that final judgment, if a certified copy is filed with the court once they obtain the judgment, then that's good for an years. I mean, like, I think 15, 20 years. It's good for a long time. And I think they can refile the judgment again before it expires. And so it continues on and on.
So it can basically exist in perpetuity.
Almost, yes. And the only thing that will get rid of it is if you file, a bankruptcy will discharge that. So if you file, the only thing that could get rid of those judgments, not all judgments, there are certain judgments you can't discharge in bankruptcy. And we've talked about that, student loans, some IRS stuff and all that. But generally, the bankruptcy will discharge all the judgments. But a lot of people don't want to file bankruptcy. You know, they're head of household. They don't want to have their wages garnished, obviously, or their bank account. So they file these petitions to stop the garnishment. So that's something that we don't really deal with in our office a lot, but it comes up because sometimes we have we have people that we work with whose wages are trying to get garnished, and we help them out with these petitions so they can stop that from happening.
If you're looking for some help on some legal guidance, 855-765-1045, the number to call. Consumer Law Hour lines are open, 855-765-1045.
Yeah, Scott, we've heard, these police cruiser chase cases. People have filed lawsuits against JSO when the police are in active pursuit of someone, and then during that pursuit, an accident happens. Either the person or the rabbit, you could call them, they're chasing. Here comes Rusty. Or the police officer causes an accident in hot pursuit of someone. And I don't know if any JSO officers are listening in. We'd like you to weigh in on what your position is on this and how y'all deal with it on a day-to-day basis. But prior to 2006, in a high-speed chase, any high-speed chase was okay, as long as you did it carefully and not negligently. That was the standard prior to 2006. So if a JSO officer was in hot pursuit of someone, all the facts would be looked at, and a jury would determine whether the officer acted carefully or negligently. That's a jury question, okay? So you could take your case in front of a jury and say, why was the police officer in hot pursuit of this defendant? All he did was run a red light. Why should he have to, you know, go 90 miles an hour down Blanding Boulevard chasing a guy who ran a red light. That was the standard. Now, after 2006, the law has changed, and the law is much more favorable towards the police, towards GSO. Basically, under the new statute passed in Florida, the police have an absolute immunity for negligence and even gross negligence. So really, there's almost a complete immunity in these high-speed chase cases, as long as these two conditions or three conditions are met. If these three conditions are met, the police or the state cannot be held responsible for anybody injured in a high-speed chase, as long as they were not reckless. Okay, reckless is a much higher standard than negligence. Reckless is almost intentional. That's hard to prove. Two, that the police officer had gone through a training session about high-speed chases, and most of them, I'm sure, do. So they meet that qualification. Then three, the chasing officer had grounds to believe that the, quote, rabbit had committed a forcible felony. So as long as he has reasonable grounds to believe that this person committed some sort of forcible felony, he basically has immunity in these high-speed chases. But we can talk about that some more when we get back. Okay.
I see we've got some callers lined up. Greg, Bill will be coming to the phones to you in just a moment. But first, we got to take a quick break. You're listening to the Consumer Law Hour on News 104.5 WOKV. We are back. We are taking your calls at 855-765-1045 here on the Consumer Law Hour on News 104.5. Our first caller this afternoon, Greg in Avondale. Greg, welcome to the show. You've got some concerns about vaccinations causing cancer in your pets. What's going on?
Yes, hi. Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. Our pets, we take them in, you know, usually annually for their checkups, and they receive their vaccines. And we've had pets for over 40 years. But recently, we just discovered that one of our pets, our cat, has a sarcoma. It's an aggressive form of cancer, and we also learned that that it's believed that the cause is from the injection. So it's an injection, what they call a fibrous injection site sarcoma cyst. And so, you know, obviously, we looked into having surgery, which runs around $15,000, and then radiation $8,000 on top of that. But when we got the vaccination, we were never told that this was a possible outcome, even though apparently they've known about this. The pharmaceutical houses that create this a batch of vaccines have known about it since 1980.
Yeah. Well, how do you know that is that's a risk of the injection? Is there anything in the literature that indicates it? I mean, how do you know it was?
Well, one is we took it to our local veterinarian who told us that that's what they believe, and then we took it down to UF in Gainesville at the veterinarian school, and they told us the same thing.
All right, so you have two sources telling you that this injection, what was the injection for?
So it's basically for any kind of injection. Apparently, even if you get the microchip, they've had one case where they've had this FIS sarcoma occur. Any kind of injection you might give your pets, like, rabies, or if they have an infection and the doctor gives them an antibiotic through the...
So it's something in the liquid of what's being injected.
It's in the carrier. Whatever the solution is,
right,
is causing this problem.
I got you.
Yeah.
I got you. Okay. So, all right. Well,
that's interesting.
I mean, that could be... I mean, let me explain what my understanding of the law is in Florida about that, and then what the options are. I mean, one, there could... I mean, typically pets are considered property. They're like chattels. So, I mean, you can't, there's no, when you sue for something like that, you basically sue for the value of the pet. What's it worth on the market? It's like a piece of property. What's this piece of property worth? What's this home worth? What's my motorcycle worth? I mean, there's really not a pain and suffering component to those cases. So you would be limited to the actual value, cash value of the pet. And so a lot of people, so to me, that's my understanding, the way Florida law is now. Some states have modified that to allow some pain and suffering components to a lawsuit. I think Tennessee is given a certain limit that you can recover for pain and suffering. So really what should be done, if your findings are correct, and I can maybe talk to you about it later, is maybe there's a possibility of a class action type thing.
Yeah.
But you're
That's
talking
what
about
I was thinking.
But you're talking the epidemiology. I mean, have you gone online to see if other people are having these? I mean, other people are complaining about it, or because?
Oh yeah, what they do normally. In fact, they've changed the protocol. They used to give it in the right hip of the animal, whether it's a dog or a cat, and dogs can get it as well. Now what they do is they give it in the tail, so that if they have to do any amputation, that's generally the course that they will do, is they will amputate to remove the sarcoma. They will amputate a portion of the tail. Oh. But in some other animals, for instance, I think they used to give it in the leg, and so they would, you know, these sarcomas would appear and they would amputate the leg.
Yeah, but what is the substance? I mean, like in Roundup, it's glyphosate. I mean, what's the substance in these injections that's causing the sarcoma?
That's a great question. But I, from what I understand, it's not the actual, virus or the or anything like that. It's whatever is in that solution that's used to that pushes it through the needle into the animal.
Mm-hmm. And people in Gainesville would not tell you what it was?
No, they didn't tell me what it was. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't ask them. I didn't think at the time. I wasn't thinking about, you know, the legal side of this. I was thinking about the welfare of our pet.
Right. Well, if you leave your phone number, I can maybe reach out to you next week and we can talk some more about it.
Okay. I'm happy to do that.
I appreciate it, Greg. Thank you.
Greg, we appreciate your call. Thank you very much. Good luck. We've got Bill in Jacksonville. He's got a question regarding aviation civil law. Bill,
hey, Bill,
thanks for calling and welcome to the Consumer Law Hour.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I know that you're going to be coming up on a hard break at the bottom of the hour. Mr. Farrah and I actually spoke about 7 years ago, I think it was, when the show first started, and he explained to me that it wasn't really within his bailiwick, but I'm basically calling today to beg him to hire someone who is familiar with aviation civil law. Since that first lawsuit, I now have two other people, and the gist of my call right now, two other people that have cost me a great deal of money in the aviation industry. But there's a gentleman in town, and I won't mention any names or any business names, but he owns a very large aviation business. He borrowed my helicopter and took off and went flying with it and forgot to put gas in it. Ended up crashing up in the Fulton Road boat ramp area, destroyed my aircraft. And when I did research, I found out that the business was kind of transferred to his wife, and he has millions of dollars of judgments against him and is judgment proof. And my little $127,000 doesn't mean anything. Is there any way around a person who's judgment proof?
Yeah, there's, first of all, I'm assuming you had no insurance coverage on the helicopter, right?
I did. They denied it because it was gross negligence, because he performed an emergency procedure off airport without the presence of an instructor. There were all sorts of codicils in the insurance that protected the insurance from paying.
So you ran through all that. You went through the policy and had somebody look at it.
Yes, sir. I did, a regular civil law attorney, but they have all said that there just aren't any aviation law attorneys left in Jacksonville.
Well,
Don Machieski was my attorney.
But there are some.
They don't.
There are some.
Okay.
I can give you a name of one. How many years has this been?
Well, the first lawsuit I talked to you about, I waited them out 14 years, and they settled for $25,000. The next lawsuit, the one I'm speaking of now, occurred on March the 10th of 2018.
All right, so you're within the statute of limitations. Is this the one where you lost, where the helicopter, you lost your $127,000?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir. It was borrowed by someone to go to the Concourse d'Elegance. Yes,
okay,
sir.
Okay, so, all right. So and you see there are codicils on your insurance policy that have prevented them from paying you for that helicopter.
Yes, sir. Gross negligence was one, and right. performing an emergency procedure without an instructor.
Okay, well, I mean, that can be subject to interpretation. Those are vague terms right there. Gross negligence can be, that's a jury question, first of all. That's not a determination that the insurance company can make. I know someone that may be able to help you with that, but he is an aviation attorney, but really it's more than just an aviation attorney. You need an insurance contract attorney, attorneys who determine, look at contracts. Now, under Florida law, if you can prove, or if the insurance company's wrong in not paying you the money they owe you, then they have to pay all your attorney's fees. So there is there is a provision in Florida law that allows you to handle these cases without having to pay your money out of your pocket. Because if an attorney believes in it, and typically they'll handle it and just get paid by the other side, which is good.
All right.
It's not going to cost you anything.
Yes, very good.
Yeah, it won't cost you anything to get an attorney involved. So what I would suggest is you leave your number with our producer, and I'll be in phone contact with you about somebody who may be able to help you with it. So it happened in 2000.
That would be wonderful.
All right, so you have all the letters from the insurance company denying you coverage and so forth?
Absolutely, letters and voicemails. I've saved them.
Okay, good. Did you ever provide the insurance company like a recorded statement?
No, sir.
Good. And do you know if the other person did?
He did three different ones, and the FAA kind of looked at that as strange that there were three different stories.
Okay, that's good. Okay, well, leave your number, Bill, and I'll be in phone contact with you about that.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for calling, Bill. We'll be back with more of your calls at 855-765-1045. After a quick update of Fox News, local weather, and traffic, you're listening to the Consumer Law Hour on News 104.5 WOKV. We're back on the Consumer Law Hour here on News 104.5. Lines are open at 855-765-1045. If you've got legal questions, our legal experts are here to help you. Chuck and Eddie Farah from the law firm of Farah & Farah, ready to take your calls. We're going to start with Robert in the Beau Claire area. He's got a question regarding a car parked on the street in front of his house. Robert, thanks for calling the Consumer Law Hour. How are you today?
Hey, Robert.
Hey guys. I'm doing really well. I think I know the answer, but I live in a neighborhood. We have deeds and covenances, but nobody, it's a small little thing, nobody really follows them, which is okay. I mean, I don't have a problem with most of that. But I've got a car, my own car, and I have it parked the correct way in front of my car. I mean, in front of my drive and in front of my house, and I park it there from time to time, and I leave it there. And so a neighbor across the street who doesn't even own the house, he's the boyfriend, comes over and puts a note on my car per section, whatever, of the deeds and covenants, says you're not allowed to, you're not allowed to park here. And I'm thinking, and you know, so he comes at me with this, and I'm like, well, nothing he can really do about it, you know, because nobody else if you're gonna single me out, then you have to go and follow the rules with everybody. And he said, well, no, I'm singling you out because he thinks I sent a city inspector after him on his pool. Mm-hmm. So I was just gone. I mean, it's parked on, there is something in the deeds and covenants that says something like parking on the right of way, but I'm not really sure it was, but it's legally parked in the street.
The deeds talk about parking on the right of way.
Have you called
this? Is this a gated community?
No, it's not.
Okay.
It's about 10 houses. Mm-hmm. You know, there are deeds and covenances, but like I said, nobody follows them, but everybody, you know, everybody maintains stuff. So no one has an issue.
Well, first of all,
he's specifically pulling.
Okay. I mean, as long as it's not a violation of the city code, or they would have to file a lawsuit against you to make you move the vehicle. Now, if they do that and they're successful, they can make you pay their attorney's fees. There's probably an attorney's fees provision in there. I don't know. But maybe because this one's not really a gated community, there may not be. But that would be their recourse. If they go to the city's not going to enforce that deed and restriction. That's not within their jurisdiction.
Right.
The city's not going to get involved because you're not violating a city ordinance. But what you could do, what I would recommend is that, just so you know what you're doing, because, you know, we're personal injury lawyers, and I'm just kind of giving you my opinion on it.
Yeah.
The best thing to do, the way to find out the definitive answer on what you could and cannot do, or what he can and cannot do, what he can do, is to hire a lawyer through the Jacksonville Bar Association. They have an attorney referral service, and for $50, you can talk to an expert that you need to talk to and get an opinion on what you should do. They'll find a real estate lawyer. You can, for 50, if you really want to find out the definitive answer, I would do that. Otherwise, you know, he may not even have standing. He may not to file the lawsuit because he's not living. He's not living in that neighborhood. And I'll tell you, even the person who's renting the house. This may be out of my area, may not have standing to sue because the deeds inure to the owner of the property. So only the owner can file it. I don't know what the deeds say about someone living on the property, and whether they can maintain an action, but probably you would argue that the owner is the only one who can do it, and he probably could care less.
Yeah. Now, single me out, though, right?
Well, maybe they can do that. I mean, you could claim some sort of constitutional thing, but I'm going back. Let's assume they can do something, or do they even have a right to do it? Because they're not the owners on the deed. I don't know if the deed allows or the law allows people who reside on the property the same rights and obligations as a person who owns it. That's a question you got to ask a real estate lawyer.
Okay.
But, you know, the Jacksonville Bar Association, well, I'll tell you what, you can, if you would leave your number, I know a real estate lawyer I could maybe reach out to and call you back. Because he does homeowners claims and stuff like that, and when it comes to the HOAs, but I really don't know the answer to that question. But from what limited knowledge I have, he's not living there. He has no right to. I mean, technically, he's trespassing on your vehicle.
Yeah, I mean, he slapped a note on it, right. Came over and said, "Move my vehicle."
Yeah, he's a trespasser. I mean, he's a.
He flat out told me. He said, I'm doing this because you turned me in for me not having a gate around my pool. And I'm like, no, I didn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could care less. So,
I don't know if you want it to escalate or not. I know you want to know where you're standing. But
I just was kind of wanted your general opinion. I think you're very knowledgeable, so that's why I was calling.
Well, no, I mean, I wish I could give you the definitive answer. Somebody from the Jack's Bar can for sure. And I'll reach out to somebody. Are the restrictions on the deed itself, or is there like another document that everybody had to sign?
There's a document that you had to sign when you purchased the house.
Okay.
I have a copy of the deeds and covenants.
Yeah. So is there anything on there about attorney's fees if you lose and so forth?
Yeah, actually, there is.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. So. Mm-hmm. That's the issue. Go ahead.
Yeah. So
the question is, does he have the right to even do anything? That's my question.
Yeah, because he's not even the owner.
He's not the owner. His girlfriend would have to file it.
Yeah, because the girlfriend owns the house.
She owns the house, or she's renting that. She owns it.
No. The girlfriend owns the house.
Okay, then she would have to file it.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, she would have to, and if that's the one you ought to be concerned about, read the agreement, because some of those agreements require them first to give you notice through some way, like a certified letter. So if they don't go through those pre-suit requirements, they're not going to be able to file a lawsuit.
Right. Yeah. They're required to go through, give me at least two letters and then, something like that.
Oh, so, okay. Right now you're okay. I mean.
Okay.
And that letter from him doesn't mean anything. He's not the owner, so.
Right. All right. I appreciate the opinion. Luck. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Right. Thanks, Robert. We appreciate your call. We've got Rick in Callahan now. Rick has a question regarding Social Security. Rick, thanks for calling the Consumer Law Hour.
Hey, Rick.
Oh, is this Eddie?
It's Eddie.
Hey, good morning. I listen to your show every Saturday. I enjoy your information. It's very, very helpful.
Thanks for tuning in, Rick. I appreciate it.
I want to ask you a question about Social Security. I started drawing Social Security when I was 62. I'm 72 now and total disabled. Can you refile?
What do you mean refile? But aren't you getting more money from your retirement than you would be getting from SSD? I mean, why would you want to refile if you're already getting it?
I'm getting Social Security, but I'm getting minimum. But when I started drawing my Social Security at 62, I was still working part-time. Then I'm totally retired. I became disabled. Now I'm totally disabled. I was wondering, can I refile for disability Social Security?
Oh, for the SSD?
Right.
Why? Are you thinking you will get more money from that than when you're getting receiving now? Is that why?
Right. Yeah. Okay. I'm sure I would.
Yeah. Oh, why? Have you talked to them about it, or have they told
you? I talked to Social Security, but you know how hard it is to get to them. No, they told me I'd have to go through a process of filing for a disability for like two or three different times to even qualify. Mm-hmm. But I had already been drawn Social Security. That's why I didn't know if you could refile.
Okay, so are you saying you now have a disability that prevents you from working?
Exactly.
Have you not worked? Has it been over a year since you worked?
Yes.
Okay. All right. I'll tell you what. We have a Social Security department in our office. Why don't you leave your phone number? Let me talk to those guys next week, and I'll call you back.
Thank you.
Because I'm a personal injury attorney. I know some about Social Security, but this particular issue, I do not know. But I'll find out for you. So you want to refile under the disability, not the Social Security you're receiving, right?
I want to refile for disability, Social Security.
Okay. All right. I got it. Rick, I'll be in phone contact next week.
Thank you, Eddie.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Rick, we appreciate your call. Thank you very much. Lines are open at 855-765-1045 on the Consumer Law Hour.
You know, getting back to this, the helicopter case that we talked about earlier, and this is true for all insurance policies in Florida, whether it's a homeowner's policy, a car insurance policy, a helicopter policy. Florida law gives the consumer a lot of power when it comes when insurance companies don't pay what they're supposed to pay. And as we all know, I mean, in this particular case, if you had to go out and hire a lawyer to fight an insurance company over about them paying for your, you know, damaged vehicle or your helicopter or whatever it is, lawyers can be quite expensive, especially when you're paying by the hour. And a lot of attorneys in this area charge hundreds of dollars per hour. And a $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 bill can be, I mean, that can happen in a couple of months. So it can cost a lot of money to take on an insurance company. But what Florida law allows you to do, if you can take off, if you take on the insurance company and you win, you can make them pay your attorney's fees. So there are a lot of lawyers, and we do some of this stuff in our own office.
Right.
We take on insurance companies on these breach of contract type situations, and you can hire a lawyer without having to pay any money up front. I mean, we handled, thank God we didn't have a lot of damage from this hurricane, but the last hurricane, we handled hurricane claims where, you know, the insurance company would offer, let's say, $10,000. And then the homeowner would come to us and say, well, you know, $10,000 is not going to do it. I mean, I've got $20,000 of damage. Well, under Florida law, if your attorney can get you a dollar more, anything more than what the insurance company is offering you, they have to pay the attorney's fees. So a lot of times, the client comes to us and says, they're only offering us 10, we need 20, and we get the 20, then we can make them pay all the attorney's fees, and the client is not out of pocket anything. But hopefully, that's what we can do.
Yeah, and then there's
talk about that. Go ahead, Chuck.
The good faith / bad faith laws, you know, that we could talk about that when we come back. Very important in Florida.
So we've got a topic coming up when we return to the Consumer Law Hour. 855-765-1045. Lines are open. We'll be right back here on News 104.5 WOKV. And we are back with the Consumer Law Hour on News 104.5 WOKV. 855-765-1045, the number to call. We've got Willie in Jacksonville who's got a question regarding power of attorney. Willie, thanks for calling the Consumer Law Hour. Good afternoon. How can we help you?
Yes. I would like to know what power does a person have if you signed it's a form that has power of attorney written on it.
Well, the person can do basically whatever you could do. So if you give someone a power of attorney, if it's a general power, I mean, sometimes there are limited power of attorneys that only allow them to do certain things. But if you give someone a general, just an open, full power of attorney, they can go to the bank and withdraw money. They can sign your name to documents. I mean, they kind of act as you would act, and unless you revoke it.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. How would you know if it's general or...
Well, it depends. I mean, it state in the document, say this power of attorney is only for, you know, signing checks, or this power of attorney is only for, you know, executing, you know, talking to my bank about my mortgage or whatever it is. I mean, you can limit it to what it is. But a general power of attorney gives people, you know, basically full power. Unless it's revoked, and it automatically is revoked upon the death of the person who gives the power of attorney. But until that person dies, if it's a general power of attorney, I mean, it's pretty powerful. I mean, you could take it to the bank and say, I want to withdraw, you know, I'm the power of attorney. Here's my ID. Here's the power. I want to withdraw the money out of the bank. Now, but what you could do is revoke it and notify your banks that, hey, this power of attorney is no longer valid. And that way they won't be able, they won't honor it.
Right.
Well, now, what are you concerned about?
This concern I have is with a relative. And I've signed a power of attorney, but I don't know what it's directed for because it didn't specify.
Yeah, well, do you have a copy of it?
No, I do not have a copy of it.
You need to go to that person and get a copy.
Okay.
And if they don't turn it over, or if you suspect them doing something, then you may want to talk to an attorney about it.
Okay.
Because,
something you can go to the Bar Association about?
No, I mean, why is the person, yeah, well, if you call the Jacksonville Bar Association, they're here in Jacksonville. For $50, they'll get you in contact with a lawyer who can help you with that. And consult with you about it. Right. But first of all, you want to get a copy of it so you know what you're dealing with. And if you have it, what you could do now is go to your banks or people you do business with and just inform them that this power of attorney is no longer valid and not to honor it if somebody shows up at the bank wanting to transact something.
Okay. I don't think it's concerning any money or anything. But
they could transfer property. Let's say you have a piece of property in your name, they could transfer that.
Yes, I do have some property, but I own my own house, and I do own some real estate that I've inherited, so that's the only thing I'm concerned about.
Yeah, you need to. That's something you should be concerned about.
Okay, I appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your call, Willie. Have a great afternoon.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.
We've got Dayton down in Ponte Vedra with a question regarding access issues with the city redoing some road work. Dayton, thanks for calling the Consumer Law Hour.
Dayton,
yes,
how you
sir.
Doing? Yeah, man.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm a little nervous, so bear with me here, okay? This is in reference to the Girvin Road Widening Project. I don't know if you're familiar with that area, but it's one route to the 9A evacuation route. They widened the roadway from two lanes to five lanes, four travel lanes and a turn lane. And they've eliminated access to three addresses from the northbound direction. And JTA refuses to respond to written and verbal requests to go over it. And during the course of construction, spoke with the roadway engineer, and they said they'd address it. And one of their options was that I just have to go somewhere and find somewhere to turn around. For 40 years, we've had access to these three addresses from northbound direction. Now, it's eliminated. And from a couple lawyers I spoke to, they said I needed to get with an eminent domain lawyer because they did buy a stretch of the property in front of all three addresses. The city bought the property, some easement, so they could make the whole thing happen. But my question is, say I do get a lawyer and try to confront JTA. If I lost the case, could JTA make me pay for their law fee?
There is a loser pays provision in Florida law. It works in the personal injury world. it works in the insurance contracts we talked about earlier, where the loser pays against if the city were suing you, or if you sue the city.
Yeah, if he sues the city.
Yeah, and you lose. I'm not sure the city would be able to make you pay their attorney's fees.
Maybe costs.
Yeah, maybe the cost. But I think, again, this is a great you ought to start with the Jacksonville Bar Association. For $50, you can talk to a lawyer about that issue, an expert in that field. I don't know what to tell you. Why are you concerned about the access? Is yours one of the three?
Yes. I mean, yes, how are you affected? Mine, for whole families.
An emergency.
My whole families.
What do you mean?
Coming into the northbound direction, like I've been coming for the last 20 years, now I can't turn left into my property. If I did turn left, I've got to go across two double yellow lines and an oncoming turn lane.
All right, so you...
Because they created a long turn lane to turn at a light
right.
a couple hundred yards away, and now I've got to go across that and oncoming traffic to get into my property. Otherwise, I've got to go...
There is access. There is actual access, but it's more dangerous than it was before.
Correct. Well, and illegal for me to turn across two double yellow lines solid and an oncoming turn lane. So technically, I'm not supposed to do that.
Were you part of the eminent domain lawsuit? You're not. I guess we're out of time.
That's it. The hour goes quickly. Dayton, we appreciate your call. Again, check with the Jack's Bar Association. Maybe they can give you some guidance on alternatives about that. On behalf of Chuck and Eddie Farah, the Consumer Law Hour brought to you by Farah and Farah every week. My name's Scott Young. Special thanks to our producer, Tom Robinson. You've been listening to the Consumer Law Hour here on News 104.5 WOKV.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.